From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, astronomer Carl Sagan on his two greatest causes, exploring other worlds and preserving our own. Sagan has lately turned his attention from the cosmos to look at how planet Earth could be devastated by even a small nuclear war. Also, playwright Christopher Durang tells us how he stopped listening to Sister Mary Ignatius and started figuring things out for himself. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of works by the 20th century Swiss composer and conductor Frank Martin. And book critic John Leonard reviews Philip Roth's new book, Patrimony, a memoir about his father's death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. Secretary of State James Baker has arrived in Geneva for talks tomorrow with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. Baker came directly from Milan, where he met Italian Foreign Minister Gianni De Michelis. Baker preceded his meeting with Aziz with a fast whistle-stop tour of European capitals to sustain support for the U.S.'s position on Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. Iraqi Foreign Minister Aziz has also arrived in Geneva. In brief remarks at the airport, Aziz said he had come in good faith. He insisted that Iraq would not yield to international pressure, but added Baghdad is ready for an exchange of views about the chances for peace in the entire Mideast region. In Baghdad, the Iraqi Information Minister, Latif Yassim, says it's up to the U.S. to make a success of tomorrow's talks between Secretary of State Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Aziz. He also denied that a number of Iraqi helicopter crews had deserted by crossing into Saudi Arabia. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports.
The minister said he wanted a deep dialogue, as he put it, to emerge from the talks in Switzerland. However, he stated again that if the Americans expected concessions from Iraq in the form of a withdrawal of forces from Kuwait, they would be disappointed. There will be no talk about a withdrawal from Kuwait. It has returned to Iraq forever, he said. Latif Jassim, asked if Iraq wanted any guarantees from the Americans, said no, and simply repeated that the requirement was for deep dialogue, the new catchphrase, and hence for peace. As for the possibility of war in a week's time, he said that it all depended on the attitude of the Americans. If they want war, we are ready, he said. We will never start a war, but if it starts, we will fight for 10 years. He also warned that it would not only be the Gulf that would burn, as he put it, but it would spread to the rest of the world.
The BBC's Bob Simpson. The Lithuanian Prime Minister and her cabinet have resigned, reportedly over relations with Moscow. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
Mrs. Prunskiene went directly to the Lithuanian parliament when she returned from Moscow and, in a short statement, announced that she was stepping down. It had already been a day of mounting political tension in the republic, where parliament had suspended plans to raise retail food prices as part of a package of economic reforms. Mrs. Prunskiene had been a keen promoter of the price reforms, but sources in the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius, say her decision to stand down came after disagreements with other members of the leadership, which stretched back to last May. Those disagreements were based on the wisdom of opening talks with Moscow, which was then implementing an economic blockade against Lithuania. Mrs. Prunskiene believed the contacts were necessary. But her enthusiastic championing of political negotiations with the Kremlin damaged her standing with many other Lithuanian politicians.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 14.6 points at 2508.17. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For years, he studied stars, but after the public TV series Cosmos, Carl Sagan became a star, America's most popular astronomer. Sagan worked with NASA on the Mariner, Viking, and Voyager planetary expeditions. He's also studied the greenhouse effect on Venus, dust storms on Mars, the clouds of Titan, and the origin of life on Earth. He's a professor of astronomy and space studies at Cornell University, where he also directs the Laboratory for Planetary Studies. In 1982, Sagan was part of a small group of scientists who hypothesized that a nuclear war could have a catastrophic chilling effect on Earth's climate that could end civilization as we know it. The theory is called nuclear winter. It's the subject of a new book Sagan has co-authored. At the time they came up with the theory, there was great fear of a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But now relations have warmed, and a strategic arms reduction treaty is in the works. We may soon be at war with Iraq, but Iraq doesn't yet have nuclear capability. I asked Carl Sagan how relevant the issue of nuclear winter is today.
First off, I would say that as long as the United States and the Soviet Union have 55,000 nuclear weapons between them, we are hardly off the hook. If only a tiny fraction, a few hundred of those weapons exploded over cities or petroleum repositories can produce a world climate catastrophe, then it's hardly time for complacency. Yes, there is progress on a strategic arms reduction treaty, and I applaud that, but that will accomplish a reduction by 30% in the roughly 25,000 strategic weapons and won't even touch the 35,000 or more tactical weapons. It's a step in the right direction, but a very small step. Because this is a time of amity between the United States and the Soviet Union, this is the time to make progress in much more massive reductions in the armaments. Nobody knows who's going to take power in the Soviet Union, or for that matter, the United States, in the coming years. If we say we're happy with the present circumstances, don't bother me, let's not worry about nuclear weapons, everything's cool, then we are saying that we're willing to hand over ourselves and our children and our grandchildren to the sanity and sobriety of every leader now and into the indefinite future of the United States, the Soviet Union, and all other nuclear-armed nations. I myself am not the least bit complacent about that. That's a very worrisome prospect.
I'm going to ask you to give us a basic description of what a nuclear winter would be and what would cause it.
Well, maybe you've seen pictures of a fire in a large modern skyscraper, and you see these roiling clouds of ugly black sooty smoke, astonishingly black. Now, if you burn a modern city, you have the concatenation of all of the buildings in the downtown area burning. If you now have, let's say, 100 cities burning simultaneously, as you would in even a small nuclear war, then you can see that there would be a large amount of this sooty smoke lifted off the surface of the earth. The clouds would merge. They would first spread in longitude and then in latitude, and you can then have a semi-opaque layer of this sooty smoke at altitude covering most of the northern hemisphere and eventually reaching into the southern hemisphere as well. As a result, sunlight has difficulty getting through the layer. It's dark on the ground. The temperatures drop because, after all, it's sunlight that warms the surface. And that is the main aspect of nuclear winter. There are a number of others, including chemically toxic fumes that are produced from the same burning of cities, breaches in the ozone layer, and radioactive fallout. The principal way in which these consequences affect us in the long term is through the destruction of crops, of agriculture. Even a few degree temperature drop, a few centigrade degree temperature drop on hemispheric average is enough to wipe out much of the food crops in the northern hemisphere. And a study by 300 scientists from 20 nations concluded that the resulting nuclear winter might condemn several billion people to death by starvation. I point out there are only 5.3 billion of us altogether on the planet.
Is a nuclear winter something that the Earth would ever recover from?
Oh, yes. The fine particles would eventually, in some years, entirely or almost entirely fall out or be removed from the atmosphere. And as far as we know, there would the Earth would recover into its ordinary climatic regime. There are some circumstances in which you push the Earth's climate far enough and it stays where you pushed it, even if the push is stopped. But there is no credible evidence that that would happen here. That is, that we would be plunged into an ice age for 10,000 years or something like that. As far as we can see, that is not likely. But to wipe out most of the human species, unfortunately, is likely.
Astronomer Carl Sagan is my guest. Without getting into this too technically, how did you come up with this theory, you and the fellow scientists who worked on the theory of nuclear winter with you?
For me, it came about in the most indirect and unintentional way. A lot of science occurs that way. It happened in 1971. I was involved in the NASA Mariner 9 mission to Mars, which was turned out the first spacecraft to ever orbit another planet. We arrived at Mars. I was involved with the imaging team to take close-up photographs of Mars and found a planet with nothing to see. It was completely covered with a massive dust storm. And we were, of course, interested to know how long it would be before we could actually start our photographic mission. And so we got to calculating what would be the effects of all this dust in the atmosphere. And one of the instruments found something quite interesting, that the atmosphere was much warmer and the surface much colder than it ordinarily is on Mars. And through that step, a long sequence of events, our team, so-called TAPS team, T-T-A-P-S, after the last names of the five of us, developed the machinery to calculate what the climatic effects would be on any planet from putting fine particles up into the atmosphere. It took us essentially a decade before we got around to calculating this for the Earth and for the fine particles put up in a nuclear war. And we did a lot of other things on the way. The results of volcanic explosions, which put fine particles up. How does that cool the Earth? The result of the huge collision that happened with the Earth 65 million years ago of a comet or asteroid that put an enormous amount of fine particles up and seems to have been the precipitating cause of the extinction of the dinosaurs and most of the other species of life on the Earth at that time. Only after all of that did we get around to nuclear war. I wish we had done it sooner.
Let me ask you a question about fire, since you've studied the effects of nuclear-related fire. One possible scenario, if there's war in the Middle East, is that oil refineries would be targeted. There's the possibility for massive oil refinery fires. What are the possible ecological effects should that happen?
Well, you're absolutely right. You don't need a nuclear weapon to blow up a petroleum refinery or an oil field or a natural gas well or a place where fossil fuels are stored. That can be done quite nicely with conventional weapons. You can also burn a city with conventional weapons, and World War II gave plentiful examples of that, Tokyo and Hamburg and Coventry, and so on. So if cities and petroleum facilities are targeted in a Near East war, it is possible that if the war were, you know, not restricted to Kuwait, but fairly wide in the Middle East, it's possible that you could produce enough sooty smoke to have at least regional climatic consequences. Now, we are trying to calculate this. It's a somewhat different story than the nuclear winter situation, and I don't know anyone who has done the calculation yet, but it seems to me that in the face of ignorance, it is wise to be cautious.
In your discussion of the fires that could be caused in a nuclear war, you talk about how fire could release toxics into the air. So much of modern synthetic material is made of substances that become poisonous when burned, and the toxics are released. In getting back to the idea of a possible massive fire in the Middle East as a result of the bombing of oil fields, would you see the likelihood of there being incredibly poisonous fumes, not only from the oil itself, but also from the fire spreading and burning other modern synthetics?
Yeah, modern synthetics and plastics, when burned, produce poison gas. Let's go back to that skyscraper fire that we talked about earlier. You often hear about people overcome by smoke. There was a social club fire in the Bronx less than a year ago, which people had obviously died in seconds. That's not overcome by smoke. That's poison gas. There's a witch's brew of deadly poison gases, of which cyanides are only one, which are released when we burn plastics and synthetics. And modern cities, including some of those in the Middle East, have large quantities of such synthetics in them. In addition, there are vast storage bins of storage tanks of chemicals that are byproducts of petroleum refining that are also toxic. So the idea that it's okay to burn petroleum facilities in the course of the war has to be looked at a little more closely than, as far as I can tell from public media, has been done so far. I sincerely hope we won't have a war. In fact, it's foolish, and the whole point of the war is clearly not jobs and not the preservation of democracy in a medieval feudal state of Kuwait. What it's about is oil, and if we had continued in the direction that President Carter had charted, the much despised President Carter in the 70s. To have alternatives to our massive dependence on fossil fuels and imported oil, we would not be in this mess today. Then we could safely apply a quarantine, a boycott, and let it run out. I still hope we will be able to do that.
Astronomer Carl Sagan is my guest, and he's one of the scientists who have come up with the theory of nuclear winter, the catastrophic climactic after effects of nuclear war. And he has co-authored a new book about that called A Path Where No Man Thought. And we'll talk more with Carl Sagan about this and other issues that he's worked on after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Carl Sagan is my guest. You're very interested in space research and exploration of the planets. A lot of that research has been related to military research as well. And I know that the military is interested in space exploration in part because of space weapon systems. You must be very ambivalent about that, because the military's interest in space helps promote causes that you're interested in too. On the other hand, it kind of gets the world a little closer to the possibility of nuclear war.
Well, I mean, it certainly is true that that the race to the moon, the Apollo program, was fundamentally about the strategic confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. It was certainly not about science, even though some good science came out of the Apollo program, although we could have gotten, I believe, just as good science for a whole lot less money by sending smart robots to the moon, but that's not the way it worked out. But in the kind of exploration that... you mentioned a moment ago that the military is interested in space exploration. They're not. They're interested in the exploitation of the space environment, but not in exploration. They're not interested in finding out what's on other planets. They're interested in using for military purposes, both defensive and offensive, the environment, the near space environment around the Earth. So the two interact only very loosely and largely in the realm of of rocket vehicles, for example. The Voyager missions to the outer solar system were lifted by a Titan launch vehicle, and Titan comes directly out of military technology, even though the boosters themselves are not classified. But still, it's I always bear in mind this strange fact that the same technology that we use, the rocket technology, the nuclear power technology Voyager and Viking used thermoelectric nuclear energy sources, and the electronics and computer technology, the same technology used to send spacecraft to other worlds, can also be used to send the agents of mass murder halfway across the planet.
You had always been very interested in Mars, and I'm wondering how the most recent findings about the planet have affected your interest, if it contradicts your expectations.
Well, one of the wonderful things that happens in the spacecraft exploration of the planets is the discovery that everybody's expectations about every world in the solar system are wrong, and that's because nature is much more clever than we are, much more subtle, much more elegant. Our ability to imagine what's out there is tremendously constrained, first of all by our own intellectual limitations, and secondly by the fact that we grow up on this one planet, and this planet isn't like any other planet. So in the case of Mars, it's a world of wonders, but with all sorts of things that nobody had guessed before we went there. For example, the surface of Mars is covered with a network of ancient river valleys. And yet today, the temperatures on Mars are so low and the atmospheric pressure is so low that liquid water is impossible. There is no liquid water on Mars. How could these rivers have formed? And the consensus answer in the scientific community is that there was once a time, several billion years ago, when the temperatures were warmer, there was much more atmosphere, and the surface was awash in liquid water. Now, how did that climate change occur? What happened on Mars to convert it from pretty close to Earth-like conditions to the deep ice age environment it's in? Isn't that something we who are pushing and pulling and tugging on our planet ought to understand? Also, if the conditions were so Earth-like then, that's a time when on Earth the origin of life had happened. Could life have arisen in that early benign environment on Mars and maybe still be around, although the Viking results show not a hint of life? Or maybe life arose and evolved and then became extinct, and there are fossil forms waiting us on Mars. Either possibility is, to me, tremendously exciting.
I think a lot of people feel, well, you know, space is really fascinating, but what possible relevance will it have for me in my lifetime? And what relevance does it have for me now, especially at a time like this, when people on Earth might be soon involved in a catastrophic war? What would you say to that? I mean, do you start to feel like it's less relevant in times like this?
Well, it's the first thing I would say is that we have to be very careful not to think of only one item at a time. There are many issues on the public and national agendas, and we have to bear many in mind. I certainly hope that the White House does that. By exploring other planets, we better understand our own. And we have an urgent need to understand our own planet because our technology is now so powerful that we're able to make profound changes in our planet. And depletion of the ozone layer and letting in deadly ultraviolet light from the sun is one example. Greenhouse warming from the burning of fossil fuels, you know, coal, oil, natural gas, is another. Nuclear winter is a third. All of these are ways in which our technology, almost without us knowing it, without hardly anybody paying any attention, now poses a danger to ourselves. Now, in all three of these cases, we have learned a great deal about them by studying other nearby planets. They are examples of Earth-like worlds that have gone in other directions. And so, if you didn't have an ounce of adventuresome spirit in you, if you didn't care at all about what other worlds were like, if the question of the origin of the Earth and the origin of life didn't interest you, whatever, I still maintain that you ought to be a strong proponent of the exploration of other planets just from the straightforward, practical, environmental information that comes out of it. There's lots of other reasons to do it, but I claim from a bottom-line, no-nonsense, no-romanticism point of view, it still makes enormous sense for us to be exploring the planets.
You are an astronomer. When you walk outside your house at night, can you actually see the stars?
Oh, yeah. I live in upstate New York where it is at least sometimes clear enough to see the stars, and occasionally you can see them with enormous splendor.
It's understood that the first photographs that were sent back from space of Earth had a profound effect on people involved with the environmental movement, because here you were able to see Earth from a distance, and suddenly the planet looked comparatively small and very fragile, and that, I think, helped give a lot of impetus to the environmental movement. I'm wondering what kind of personal effect those photos had on you when you first saw them.
Well, I agree. They were tremendously moving. You saw this world, and the continents had exactly the configuration alleged by the map makers. They knew their stuff. And you could see it as a lovely blue and white world set against this velvet backdrop of space. And immediately the vulnerability and fragility of the Earth cries out to you. I had the opportunity recently, when the Voyager 1 spacecraft had passed the orbit of Neptune and Pluto, to be involved in turning the cameras around and photographing the Earth from that distance beyond the furthest known planet. And there it was as a point of light, a pale blue dot on which lived every human being we love, we've heard about, every human being that ever lived, every inventor, every corrupt politician, every lover, every child, every great religious leader, all lived out their days on that blue dot. I found that a tremendously inspiring experience, and sort of renewed my dedication to preserving and cherishing this little world.
Carl Sagan, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And my guest has been astronomer Carl Sagan, and he's the co-author of a new book about nuclear winter. It's called A Path Where No Man Thought. Next time, we debut a new Fresh Air theme, and we feature a concert with its composer, Joel Forrester, of the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You was a controversial comedy about an authoritarian nun. The playwright, Christopher Durang, got his education in Catholic schools. Coming up, Christopher Durang on faith and losing faith. He's now writing a pilot for Fox TV, a comedy about dysfunctional families. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about the works of a little-known Swiss composer and conductor, Frank Martin. And book critic John Leonard reviews Patrimony, a new memoir by Philip Roth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. Secretary of State James Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz have both arrived in Geneva, Switzerland. They will hold talks tomorrow on the Persian Gulf crisis. Following meetings this morning in Paris with the French president and foreign minister, Secretary Baker said France and the U.S. are in complete agreement on their views of the Gulf crisis. Lynn Terry has more from Paris.
Secretary of State Baker said the French and Americans totally support the United Nations Security Council resolutions against Iraq. French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas agreed with that, saying Iraq must withdraw from Kuwait by January 15th. The French, however, have said that it would be physically impossible for the Iraqis to get out of Kuwait in only 7 days. But if there was any disagreement about the deadline during the meetings this morning, the two leaders did not let it show. Dumas, however, did suggest there were differences on another point, the holding of an international conference on the Middle East. The French are willing to link the conference to an Iraqi withdrawal, and Dumas said he made the French position clear. But Baker said all agree there must be no linkage. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Saudi defense minister has denied reports that the crews of 6 Iraqi helicopters defected with their aircraft to Saudi Arabia yesterday. The BBC's Mark Laity reports.
According to the Saudi press agency, Prince Sultan vehemently denied the reports of the defections of the Iraqi helicopter crews, who are said to have flown their aircraft from Kuwait and landed in Saudi Arabia. The prince said the story was baseless. The American defense sources who released the news are refusing to comment further to avoid a clash with the Saudis, but they are not withdrawing the original information. Prince Sultan's remarks have also caused puzzlement because the story was based on information supplied by Saudi and Kuwaiti sources. There's been a steady trickle of Iraqi deserters since the invasion of Kuwait, and they've usually been held by the Saudis, whose troops are closest to the border and have traditionally released very little information about them.
The BBC's Mark Laity. California Senator Alan Cranston is too ill from radiation treatment for cancer to undergo public questioning before the Senate Ethics Committee, according to his defense attorney. He's waived his right to a public hearing. Cranston is one of the so-called Keating Five, a group of 5 senators being investigated for their ties to former savings and loan operator Charles Keating. Cranston is too weak even for a videotaped question and answer session. Steve Clark, the guitarist for the heavy metal rock group Def Leppard, has died in his sleep at his London townhouse, according to police. Authorities say they are investigating the cause of Clark's death, but say there are no suspicious circumstances. Stock prices closed lower today. The Dow fell 13.36 points to end the day at 2509.41. Volume was moderate. 144 million shares changed hands. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I'll talk with playwright Christopher Durang. But first, the music of Frank Martin. The Swiss composer Frank Martin, who died in 1974, would have been 101 this year. The Swiss record company Yecklin has been releasing a series of commemorative recordings on compact disc. Most of them are with Martin conducting or playing his own music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Years ago, I heard a poignant, melancholy piece of music on the radio that haunted me. It was from something by the Swiss composer Frank Martin. I'd never heard of him at the time. In fact, he's still not all that well known in this country. And that shouldn't be surprising. He shares with some 20th century French composers an interest in vocal and choral music, often of a religious nature. Yet he doesn't have the glamour of Durufle, the sensual mysticism of Messiaen, or Poulenc's uninhibitedness. Martin's unique combination of Schoenbergian tone rows with traditional harmonies is more austere, unsettling, even bleak, like the religious films of Ingmar Bergman or Robert Bresson. Like Poulenc or Hindemith, Martin wrote for some surprising solo instruments like trombone or saxophone. He was one of the first composers to discover the modern possibilities of the harpsichord. Here's a passage from his best-known piece, the Petite Symphonie Concertante, for harp, harpsichord, piano, and double-string orchestra. Martin wrote this moody, mercurial, inventive piece between 1944 and 1945. One of Martin's most extraordinary works is one of his last, his Requiem. He said he always knew he would write a Requiem, but for years he didn't feel he was ready. A visit to three holy places, St. Mark's in Venice, the Cathedral in Palermo, and the Greek temples at Paestum, near Naples, finally inspired him, as he said, to build a temple of his own. The major part of Martin's Requiem is devoted to the Dies Irae, the music for the Day of Judgment. He said that what he tried to express was the clear will to accept death, to make peace with it, and see it in all the anguish and suffering, physical and emotional, that it bears. He said that death represents so much unfulfilled potential. But what's equally important, Martin said, is the willingness to behold death in full confidence of the forgiveness to come, in full expectation of true, eternal peace. This recording of Frank Martin's Requiem was made at its world premiere at the Lausanne Cathedral, May 4, 1973, with Martin himself conducting the Orchestre de la Suisse Romande. There are four vocal soloists and a crucial organ part, played by André Louis. Martin died the following year. By the way, I've never discovered what that first Martin piece was that struck me so powerfully, but I'm happy to keep listening to Martin until I find it.
Lord Schwartz reviewed Martin conducts Martin. This is Fresh Air. Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You is Christopher Durang's best-known and most controversial play. This comedy about an authoritarian nun was picketed in several cities by offended Catholics. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich once described Durang as a master at framing metaphysical conundrums in the terms of pop culture kitsch. Sister Mary is included in a new edition of Durang's plays called Christopher Durang Explains It All for You. It contains five other plays, including Beyond Therapy, which Robert Altman adapted into a film. Christopher Durang's last play, Laughing Wild, flopped, but he had more success in 1989 with his comedy cabaret act Chris Durang and Dawn. The comic premise was that he had given up playwriting and was now touring Ramada Inns.
I came out singing bad, and then we segued into Bally High, and my backup group had very corny hand motions and things, And then in describing who I was, I would say I'm Chris Durang, and I used to be a playwright, but it was too hard. I'm hoping this is easier. Dawn and I have been traveling around to Ramada Inns. It's been horrible. Things like, and saying that playwriting was too hard. A lot of people assumed that I was telling the truth about the Ramada Inns, but in truth, we haven't been traveling to Ramada Inns, but I suppose we could have been.
But I bet you were telling the truth about playwriting,
I'm kidding about giving up playwriting, but on the other hand, there was a kernel of truth in that I just was feeling a little discouraged by writing for New York theater, and that in a certain sense it seemed easier to become a cabaret singer.
What was discouraging about New York theater? What still is discouraging about it?
It's a topic that I actually bore myself with a little bit, which is that it's just the New York Times is very powerful, and so if you're not liked by their critics or their main critic, but actually anybody who writes for them, it's just hard to get an audience or hard to get a show to run. And on one hand, I've been successful with my plays, but looked at a different way. It's only been Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You that was critically acclaimed and then ran for a couple of years. So I've just felt a little discouraged by cumulatively the plays of mine that have not been embraced critically. So it just, I suppose I shouldn't care about it, but it becomes hard not to, at least for me.
There seems something almost masochistic for you to be a playwright. And one of the things is, you know, you loved Broadway. I know you grew up loving movies, but you've chosen for yourself a form of writing that far fewer people see.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is frustrating that it's a small audience. I think I was realizing recently, the Broadway that I grew up with in the late 50s and early 60s, in a way doesn't exist anymore. It's shrunk. There are far fewer plays, mm-hmm. and a lot of the ones that succeed are kind of the musical spectacles, some of which I like. For instance, I actually liked Les Miserables, but other ones... Anyway, they're not what I aspire to. I don't hope to write one. I don't hope to meet up with Andrew Lloyd Webber and write Dogs or something. And I hoped that I would write a comedy play that succeeded on Broadway, and with Beyond Therapy, I feel I came close. I haven't actually had a Broadway play since then. That was 1982. So... you're right, and sometimes I'll go to a Broadway play that is successful and running, and I'll kind of look and see the what seems like a limited social class that you're writing to and for, and the prices are so expensive that, in a certain sense, I am realizing that maybe it's masochistic or not thrilling to be writing for that audience. So I've also written screenplays that have unfortunately not been made, been paid for, but haven't been made, and I'm... As we speak, I've taken a job a few months ago to write a sitcom for the Fox Network, which is the first time I've tried that. And one of the things that interests me, aside from being well paid is that the audience is very broad. I mean, I know theater people traditionally perhaps look down on television, but I'm going through a legitimate period of not looking down on it and being interested by the fact that you can reach such a large audience.
What's the premise of the sitcom?
The premise, I'm calling the show Dysfunction the TV Show. And it's, you know, the whole phrase dysfunction and dysfunctional families is, which I think is interesting and truthful, is on the other hand on every single talk show all the time.
So that's
it's on
right,
the
that's right.
brink of becoming a cliche. And so my show is about a dysfunctional family and two family therapists who are working with them and filming them at home and interviewing them and having them in family group therapies. And, of course, I do mean it to be a comedy. So I've just actually handed in my first draft, and on this, in a couple of days I'll be talking to them to see what their feedback is. So, gee, I hope they like it, and I hope that we get on the air at some point. But anyway, that's what the show is about.
Your best-known play is Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You.
Mm-hmm.
And in just about every city you played in, there were attempts by Catholics to close the play down. Mm-hmm. Were you flattered by the attention?
I always felt that it was a very, you know, conservative group of Catholics and sometimes non-Catholics who were offended by the play. I wasn't expecting them to be offended. I thought that they would just say, oh, well, I don't agree. So I was not flattered. I was surprised. And I guess I might have been flattered. The only reason I wasn't is that I took, since in a couple of cities, notably St. Louis, there were attempts to change the Missouri State Art Council funding laws. It was kind of a dry run for what happened in with the National Endowment and Jesse Helms this past year. The topic, however, not being sexual content, but being religious content and religious criticism. But whenever people want to change laws because of something that's been written, I'm not flattered. I'm alarmed.
Sister Mary Ignatius is one of the plays included in your book. Can I get you to do a short reading from it?
Sure.
I think it's legitimate to ask you because you've acted as well as written.
yes, I have sometimes. The first part of Sister Mary Ignatius is a lecture in which she's describing, explaining it all for you, meaning how the entire world works in her opinion. And she gets to a part where she's taking questions. Here's one of her questions she takes. She's reading... The question is, what exactly went on in Sodom? Sister's irritated. Who asked me this question? She then goes on to answer something else but comes back to it. I'm going to talk about Sodom for a bit. To answer your question, Sodom is where they committed acts of homosexuality and bestiality in the Old Testament, and God, infuriated by this, destroyed them all in one fell swoop. Modern-day Sodoms are New York City, San Francisco, Amsterdam, Los Angeles, well, basically anywhere where the population is over 50,000. The only reason that God has not destroyed these modern-day Sodoms is that Catholic nuns and priests live in these cities, and God does not wish to destroy them. He does, however, give these people body lice and hepatitis. It's so hard to know why God allows wickedness to flourish. I guess it's because God wants man to choose goodness freely of his own free will. Sometimes one wonders if free will is worth all the trouble, if there's going to be so much evil and unhappiness, but God knows best, presumably. If it were up to me, I might be tempted to wipe out cities and civilizations, but luckily for New York and Amsterdam, I'm not God.
A lot of kids who go to Catholic school, no matter how they end up feeling years later, while they're in Catholic school, want to become a nun or a priest.
Yes,
those are like the role models they have around them. Did you go through a period like that yourself?
Yes, I did. Yes, well, particularly in the 50s and 60s, being a nun or a priest was a bit pitched to you as a child. It was sort of, it was kind of like if you're really, really lucky, you'll discover that God has chosen you for this special life. So, you know, children who want to please do go through periods of thinking, gee, wouldn't this be wonderful if I have this special calling? And then then the other place where I sort of thought of being a priest is that in high school is one place where some children stop believing. That did not happen to me. I became more believing in high school and more religious. And also I really liked and still do like the priests who taught me, these Benedictine priests. And the school was on the grounds of a monastery, and the life of the monastery seemed terribly peaceful and serene and centered, because one thing that's appealing about the religious life is that if you do believe in God, these are people who have decided that their belief in God is the most important thing in life, and it's not to succeed on Broadway, and it's not to make a lot of money. It's to live for your central belief. So there is something very attractive about that. And so when I was in high school, I found that very appealing, and there was a part of me that thought that living that life would be very satisfying.
How did you lose your faith?
Well, one day I just misplaced it. I looked under the bed. I will answer the question, but I feel slightly self-conscious because it's very common. It happens to lots of people, and it's also very young man-ish. It had to do with the belief that God was watching over us and somehow was involved with man's history. And it both had to do with things like family upset on the one hand. So you would see family upset and you had been taught to pray for it, but you sort of thought, well, is God up in heaven listening to these prayers and saying, no, I have some special reason, I'm going to let it go on. Then the other thing was that when I was in college is when the Vietnam War was happening and the protests were happening, and I was actually part of the liberal group of Catholics who were very opposed to the war. And we would also pray for the end of the war. And, you know, if you focused on the suffering of the, you'd watch the napalm children on television and you would pray that God would stop this war. And then when the war wouldn't stop, I got confused what prayer was for. And if God was really involved, you know, does God sit up there I make a joke in my newest play, Laughing Wild, which is, that when I would watch people on the Tony Awards thank God for helping them win the Tony Awards, I had to ask myself, well, is God silent on the Holocaust, but he involves himself in the Tony Awards? So that's the issue that made me suddenly just feel that what I'd been taught, that God was up there involved in our daily history, wasn't true. But that's kind of what made me stop believing.
Do you still feel that you miss having faith, that you'd like to have
faith
if only you could?
Yes, absolutely. And I've also, it's such a terrible cliche that as we get older, we do mellow and all these things. The word spiritual used to be meaningless to me. And now I don't quite know what it means, but I have this little buzz of positive feeling about whatever spiritual is. I don't know what, but I'm starting to have the flickerings of belief in something, but I'd be hard-pressed to say what it was.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Christopher Durang Explains It All for You is published by Grove Weidenfeld. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. How are you?
What do you have from the Gulf?
Well, among other news, we have an attempt to sort out what actually happened with those Iraqi defectors to Saudi Arabia, if there were any. Our reporter in Dahram, Deb Amos, will try to explain why it was that there were reports yesterday of several helicopter pilots coming over from Iraq, and then strenuous denials today by the Saudi defense minister. He said no defections at all. We'll try to see what's going on. Also, a report on religious fundamentalism in Turkey. Turkey, a country where nearly everyone is Muslim, but where the country is officially secular, is experiencing a rise in what some call a dangerous Islamic fundamentalism.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Philip Roth has invented all kinds of strained family relationships in his novels Portnoy's Complaint, The Ghostwriter, and Zuckerman Unbound. In his new memoir, Patrimony, he writes unflinchingly about the death of his father. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
3 years ago, in a book called The Facts, which he called a novelist's autobiography, Philip Roth let us know he wasn't really Zuckerman, or Tarnopol, or Kepesh, or Portnoy, or any other character in any of his novels, no matter how closely those novels seemed to resemble his own life. What he had always done as a writer, he said, was to set out spontaneously to improve on actuality, in the interest of being more interesting. Thus, according to Facts, Philip was really a good boy, who wrote bad boy books to keep his creative edge and save himself from being desexualized. And there were passages in Facts where he made us believe him, especially when he wrote about his mother, into whose sleek black coat he'd wormed his way as a child. A privileged, pampered papoose, he says. The unnameable animal me, bearing her dead father's name. The protoplasm me, boy baby, and body burrower in training, joined by every nerve ending to her smile and her sealskin coat. To be it all was to be her Philip. Of course, Roth almost spoiled it all by dragging in Zuckerman to criticize the manuscript of Facts. But I liked that mother. She died in 1981. Philip's father, Herman, blind in one eye, deaf in one ear, started to die 8 years later, of a tumor on the brain. And the good boy stopped writing novels to think about and care for him. Patrimony is his splendid account of that custodianship and its baffling emotions. Herman was difficult, but we don't choose our fathers. And unlike Zuckerman's father, he was fiercely proud of his novelist son. And the son discovers in this stubborn, brusque, and grudging old man surprising aspects of himself. There are several patrimonies. The old shaving mug handed down by generations of Jewish immigrants. His incontinent father's own excrement, which Philip must clean up, as once he was cleaned up after as a baby. An obsession with memory, with never forgetting anything. And equally important to a writer, a distinctive voice. He taught me the vernacular, says Philip. He was the vernacular, unpoetic and expressive and point blank, with all the vernacular's glaring limitations and all its durable force. Patrimony, the book, sticks mostly to this vernacular. Neither ironic nor sentimental, it finds its effects in the perfect detail. Herman remembers relatives, neighbors, and bygone Jewish boxing champs. For him, says his son, to be alive is to be made of memory. To him, if a man's not made of memory, he's made of nothing. They joke together about a survivor who has written a pornographic bestseller about the Holocaust. There is a scene in which Philip sleeps with his father, as if a poultice to the wound. Zuckerman would have worried this bed with every imaginable ambiguity and embarrassment. The good son merely reports it. He wasn't just any father, he says. He was the father, with everything there is to hate in a father and everything there is to love. There's that word, love, so rare in Roth. He imagines his father's tumor this way. The fingernail that had been aggrandizing the hollows of his skull for a decade, the material as obdurate and gristly as he was, that had cracked open the bone behind his nose, and with a stubborn, unrelenting force just like his, had pushed tusk-like through the cavities of his face. Love is just as hard, just as inexorable, like this book. His father dies, age 86. Philip, at last, is all grown up.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. The theme music we've used for the last 3.5 years was composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we debut Fresh Air's new theme music, and we feature a concert with its composer, pianist Joel Forrester of the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.